There are questions. So when I said only one question per person, I am going to... You probably borrowed somebody else's allowance. And I can look at the handwriting and see if he's in the same. Remember the story of the two twin boys who went to the same school. And when they had to do an essay titled My Dog, and then when they went to school, they got called to the principal's office for cheating. So, what do you mean cheating, sir? He said, well, your essays are exactly the same. Word for word the same. What do you expect? It was the same dog. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, on the last day there are quite a few of us going to airport, leaving latest 9:50 a.m. We would like to request if we can have the metta meditation and blessings after chanting before breakfast. Thereby, that's it. Oh, thank you. That's the last day. There is no last day. It's always coming back again, another day. So, the last day after chanting before breakfast. But some people aren't here for breakfast. Maybe we'll have it on the last day instead of breakfast. Yeah. Any takers? You're leaving at 9:50. There's plenty of time after breakfast. Because 8 o'clock is when we have the talk. What do you mean, latest 9:15? Leaving latest 9:15? It's easy to get that in before you leave at 9:15, you haven't got hardly any bags anyway. You've renounced everything and let everything go. So what do you need baggage for? No worries, don't worry. Anyway, wait and see. I have many experiences where I looked at things, for example, trees, but they stopped to exist. Oh my goodness. Any trees left? You should look at your baggage. Look at that and see if it stopped to exist. If the five khandhas are conjoined, then why didn't perception arise for me to perceive tree and knowing consciousness for me to know them? I'm confused. Ah, please help. Oh, come on, keep it simple. Just a tree's a tree. But you looked at the things and the trees. If the five khandhas are conjoined, then why did perception arise for me to perceive tree and knowing consciousness for me to know them? I'm confused. I'm confused too. Your confusion is infectious. So, in the seeing, there will just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the cognized, just the cognized. And the known, just the known. The tree will just be the tree. And you will be you. And never the twain shall meet. Because if you do meet the tree, if you are really conjoined, then you'll go bang into the tree. Okay, they stop to exist. I don't know. Well, I think when you look at the tree, it's just one way of perceiving what I think you mean, sense perception. In other words, that sometimes that when you see something, there's an image there, but the image there, the one who is looking, sometimes it's like you almost get entangled into the experience and start seeing it in different ways. Just like the very common experience of that when you're in the football match, you're watching it on a TV, but you are sucked into it in the movie. I was, one of the other movies I watched when I was a young man was Tarantula. Tarantula was a spider, just an ordinary spider, but you know, many people don't like tarantulas. But this spider was involved in a nuclear accident and mutated to be this huge monster of a spider. And would creep up on people and sting them and kill them and chew them later on at his leisure. This spider was not a vegetarian at all. He just, well, actually what he really liked, and I noticed that many many of the movies which I watched when I was a young man, the tarantulas or other monsters, they only chase beautiful young women. If you were fat and old, he wouldn't go near you. It's true. Guys have sometimes died protecting their girlfriends or their wives, but the ones they really went after, it was really sexist. I don't know why they did that, but anyway, that's what happened. Anyway, watching the tarantula movie, and then as you were watching it, there would be always someone in the audience say, "Hey, behind you, tarantula!" And it was just a movie, it's already been done, filmed. But we get sucked into it. That's our problem. So in this case, it may be that you became like, as it were, one with the tree, simply because you got sucked into it. And you sort of felt it, perceived it in a different way. There's many ways of perceiving things. And so one of the best ways of perceiving it, of course, is nanya, none of my business. I'm not quite sure exactly what you mean there, but anyway, that could be it. The trees, but they stop to exist. I mean, are separate from the person who's observing. It could be, though, the quantum, where to create a tree, you have to observe it first, to collapse the probability equation represented by the Schrödinger equation. This is the great story of Schrödinger's cat. Schrödinger definitely wasn't a Buddhist. What he did to his poor cat. He put this cat into a box, sealed box, and in that box there was a cyanide capsule. And the chances of the cyanide capsule breaking and poisoning the cat was 50-50. It was a decay of a cesium atom. And that for the time they were going to put this cat in the box, there's a 50-50 chance. Probabilities were so evenly balanced that the cesium atom would decay and trigger the crushing of the glass around the cyanide and the cat would be dead. So the thing was, before they opened the box, 50-50 chance the cat was dead or alive. But in between, before they looked, was the cat alive or was the cat dead? It was neither. It was the third possibility, just between life and death. I don't know what the cat thought about that. but that was actually the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum theory. And you know, it always seems to be gaining ground. So, weird is this wheel. So are you really enlightened before you check? If there's a 50-50 chance, before you check, you're neither enlightened nor not enlightened. You're in between somewhere. The world is weird. Have I totally bamboozled you with science? You're confused, but anyway. Why did perception arise me to perceive tree and knowing consciousness? Oh, there's so many different ways you can look at things. Dear Ajahn Brahm, please tell me the story of the bushfire that took place some years ago around Bodhinyana Monastery. Oh, that was scary. It actually wasn't that scary, because bushfires, a big bushfire came, and it was a ground fire. It was the hottest day ever in Western North. That's not a joke. 46 point something degrees before the fire came. And this big fire came, blaze, unstoppable. And the trees didn't catch fire. They exploded. Boom. It was really amazing to see just the power of nature sometimes. So you just observe it. And then anyway, we were all right. It was really weird things that We had it all worked out, what we were going to do when the fire was coming, take refuge in the main hall, because the radiant heat is one of the killers. So we took refuge in the main hall just to wait for the fire front to pass. Then we were going all out afterwards with our hoses, ready to sort of fight the fire. And it's amazing just how stupid people can be. First of all, before the fire came, we knew it was coming. And so we had all our vehicles. I said, park them in front of the hall in case we need to leave quickly. And you know what people did? They parked them with the nose facing into the hall, with the keys taken out in their pockets, locked. And what are you thinking about? You know, you need the keys in the engine, in the lock. No one's going to steal them. If we've got to, you know, leave quickly, you don't have to think, oh, who's got the keys? I think you had the keys. Didn't you? And then, that's what happens. And then the next thing is that you have to reverse because you're facing the wrong way. So I had to tell them, look, guys, reverse them, keys in the engine in case we need to leave quickly. Doors unlocked. So that's what we did. And then the person who ruined it all, I don't mind saying this, was one of the firefighters. You know, he freaked. And he was the one who lost it. We were nice and calm. He said, get out quick, now! And you know, that was he had the authority to order us to leave, but that, I've always been told, that's the worst time to leave, when the fire is actually hitting you. Because people panic then. And one of the people did panic. This fellow, I don't mind telling his story, that he was, first of all, he was an Afghan. He was a refugee when, I think, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. He went to Iran, and then he had to leave there when after the Islamic Revolution. So he eventually was like, he had a refugee visa from the United Nations. And eventually just was working his way. He was in Malaysia, outside of KL, and he was going to go and listen to a talk by Dr. K.C. Damanandi. He got a book about him just on the desk. And so he had a little car. He was filling up with gas, with petrol, in one of the petrol stations in KL. And he was just, you know, talking with the petrol attendant. He said, oh, where are you going tonight? He said, oh, I'm going to go and have a listen to this monk in sort of Brickfield's temple. Really good monk. And then the petrol said, oh, just hold on a moment. And he went to ring and called the police. Because this person, and the police said, well, you know, you can't go and see a Buddhist talk. You're a Muslim. He said, no, I'm not Muslim, I'm a Buddhist. He said, let's see your ID. And his first name was Muhammad. That was the end of that conversation. And he said, get out of the country quick, otherwise we'll arrest you. So one of the first things he did when he came here, he changed his name from Muhammad to Amaro. But anyway, he's a really nice guy, but the poor fellow, that, why do these things happen? What are people thinking? Because, you know, when the guy from the fire department said, you have to leave now, we all got into the car and got ready to go, and this fellow was missing. You know what he decided to do? And I don't know why, he decided to change his trousers. I'm honest, look, this is not an exaggeration. And he came running out, you know, just half his trousers down, pulling up his trousers. You know, he did really get caught with his trousers down, and it wasn't just his going to the toilet, he just, you know, sometimes I don't know what happens to people when there's a fire or something like that, there's a brain gets on fire and does stupid things, but we all got out easy enough. But then afterwards, you know, that when just down the bottom of the road there, that was the evacuation point, and then that was when Channel 7 or Channel 9, I forget which one it was, they were interviewing me. And they said, now, sir, now, what happened? And I said, oh, well, you know, the fire came, and just trees exploded, bang, bang here, and bang there. And it was really good fun. And then, of course, I don't watch TV, but it was on the TV that night. And the next couple of days later, you know, the interviewer called me and said, no, this is, I'm not just praising myself. She said, this is weird. I've been covered many emergencies, you know, and people are always just so tense afterwards. They're so anxious. He said, you were just so peaceful and calm. You're just about to lose your life or lose your monastery. He said, yeah, well, easy come, easy go. Anicca vada sankhara. And so that's why afterwards she wanted to invite me onto this show, the Hinch Report. Remember Hinch Report? And I said, oh yeah, because she wanted to say, why the heck, how come a Buddhist monk, life-threatening situations, does not react like other people? But then apparently I didn't eventually go on it. But I think the other people told me, said, oh no, don't go on there. No, this is one of those guys who will rip you apart. I said, it doesn't matter, there's nothing in there to rip apart. So anyway, that they wouldn't let me go on it. But anyway, I was wanting to. But later on we had the psychology students from the university came. Because it was excellent. They knew this was a very life-threatening situation. It was really, really dangerous. And they wondered if we had any trauma. And they asked me and the other monks, did you wake up in the middle of the night the next week thinking about the fires? Did you actually need any medication to get to sleep at night? I said, no. And he said, no, don't you have flashbacks? No. Don't you have tremors? No. Don't you have... And they just said, sorry, but we've been wasting our time because you guys just don't fit in. Can't you get a little bit of trauma for us? But some of the most stupid things, for media, they had this fellow from the ABC TV came the next day. And just after the fire, we were just cleaning up everything. It was dirt everywhere. There was just so much dust and dirt in the air that every time you wash something, 5 minutes later, it was covered with soot again. And we're just really working really hard. And this guy came up and said to me, because I was there at the time and I was in charge, and he said, can I ask all your monks to come into the hall so you can pray, for thanks to your Buddha that they saved your fire? I said, what? No, we're all busting our butts trying to clean up the place, get the water up and get everything back together. So it's, and you want us to stop for your stupid TV show? They never came back again. It's incredible. There you are working really hard. And just we have to stop to do a ceremony so we can pray for sort of thanks. Anyway, it's all good fun. But anyway, miracles, there was one place which I remember because when the guys from town came in, actually to check what happened and why it had happened. And he looked at one of those A-frames huts. And then I was with him, I always remember this. He said, he looked at me, he looked underneath it, around it, looked at the slope, looked at everything. And he turned around, he said, Ajahn Brahm, this should not be here. Should have all burnt up. But it didn't. Who knows? But there was, if you may check this out, not Bodhinyana Monastery, but this was on a TV show, which I haven't seen, but people told me about it, called The Unexplained. I don't know if anyone has seen it. Probably, it's one of these things which have been syndicated. The weird stuff which happens in this world. And on The Unexplained, they showed one of these really terrible bushfires in California. And they showed this hillside where every house had been reduced to smoke and ashes. It looked like a battlefield after a nuclear war. No green, no life, just ash and destruction. And as they panned the hillside, nothing was there. And then there was a big house in the middle, untouched. No, not charred, everything just perfect. And then the house to the right was also destroyed. Above and below, utter destruction. So they wanted to find out why this house was not destroyed when all the others were. So they interviewed the owner, who was a Korean-American, who'd migrated to the United States with hardly anything, worked really hard, saved up enough money, and this was his first house. I said, well, how come your house survived? Did you have sprinklers on the roof? Did you have high-pressure hoses? Did you have fire shutters? Why did your house survive? He said, I had none of those. None of those at all, just an ordinary house. Well, why did your house survive? And he said, well, maybe it was because of my brother. Because when I first built this house, I invited my brother, who was a Buddhist monk, to do some chanting in my house. That is why it survived. Ooh. So don't go inviting the monks to go and chant in the house. We're busy enough as it is. Crikey. That's what he said. And I don't know, that was on the TV, and that's why people said, ooh, who knows? Anyway, please, oh, that's the bushfires. Thank you so much for making such a wonderful, relaxing center for practice. Thank you also for the great similes and stories, which makes it easier to understand. But just joking. 2 days ago, you mentioned a discourse the Buddha provided about seeing being just a seeing and hearing being just a hearing. I notice that when I get one sensory stimulus, the mind proliferates to the other senses. For example, in meditation, I hear a bird sound. I imagine a vision of this, of the bird. Oh, I see food, and I imagine its taste. I can see these mental proliferations to other senses and create disappointment and suffering. What kind of meditation practice helps the mind to stop these mental proliferations, i.e. to see sound as just a sound? Do you think the Buddha didn't have these mental proliferations, or would he have been aware of it and not fallen for it? Probably not fallen for it. In the scene, he's just the scene. Maybe in the time of the Buddha, but these days we have what we've called digitally enhanced visual effects. Is it real, what you see? What you hear, is it just the heard? Or is it fake news? How do you know what's real and what's not real? In the old days, it was just so easy to find out what's real and real. But these days, sometimes, my goodness, have you ever been deceived by appearances, even by sounds? So was it somebody would say, hope you don't mind this, a story. Somebody told me that after the ghost story yesterday, last night, that when they went to sleep here, they couldn't sleep. They were lying in their bed, and then they heard something walking outside, up and down, until it stopped right outside their window and knocked. And he was scared. Should he open the window or should he not? I am exaggerating what you told me yesterday, but, well, this morning, whatever it was. But should he open it, should he not? If that was you, would you open the window? Or would you put another cover on and decide? He decided to open the window, find out, courageous. Finding out what it is, what this ghost is. Have you ever seen a ghost? I know there's a journalist here, an ex-journalist. You know, if you saw a ghost, you should do an in-depth interview with the ghost. mean, that's never been done before. You know, it's, what does a ghost do during the day? They only come out at night. You know, just as they sleep or hide somewhere, because they only come out at night. And also, you know, do they get married or fall in love? For example, and then a nice female ghost and a nice monk ghost, and they meet one another in the astral plane, and do they actually just, you know, they get the heart palpitations and the hot flushes, and say, oh, you know, you're the ghost of my dreams. So, I mean, you could do that as a journalist. And because it'd be very easy to sell, because, you know, especially some people I know, because they're very famous journalists. They call them ghost writers. You can see that one coming. Anyway, where was I going with it? Oh, yeah. So he opened it. What did he see? Yeah, that's right, kangaroo. Just a kangaroo, just hopping. Because at night time, they don't really hop. They just put their legs forward, and they just, or their tail, and they just move forward. It sounds, to all intents and purposes, like a human being. But that poor kangaroo, sort of, he was so, you know, having a window open and a guy looking out, that really scared the kangaroo. So I'm sure that kangaroo was traumatized. So anyway, it's just the senses, they just make and what is it called? It just proliferates and embellishes the sounds. So Buddha didn't have these mental faculties. No, it's just a ghost, that's all. It's just the sound, it's just the smell. Because sometimes people like all sorts of different smells. One of my favourite smells, it's weird, but it's bat poo. I've got two favourite smells, bat shit, and the other one is tar. And the reason I like tar smell is because, you know, after the Second World War in London, all the metal railings were taken away actually to make bombs and shells and stuff. That's where they got a lot of the metal from. So they always put wooden railings around the playing fields and parks. And the only way to keep them preserved against the weather was to paint them once a year with tar. And I had just such wonderful memories of playing soccer in these parks that smell was part of my childhood. And whenever I smell tar, it gives a nice, warm, happy smell, because I associate that with spending days and days and days, especially in the summer, just playing soccer with my friends in the local playing fields park. And the other thing with bat poo, that was because some of the monasteries where I meditated, some of the best monasteries were in caves. And I love caves, and of course, caves are where the bats live. And so those caves and the bat poo, I associated them with some beautiful meditation. And so whenever I smell bat poo, that's a beautiful smell for me. Bat poo and tar. It's weird, isn't it? But it's all, that's what a lot of smells are, just association. And you associate them with some very wonderful times of your life. So, but you don't proliferate, you just, feels good. Anyway, Ajahn, it's never happened to me, but what should we do if meditation takes a dark turn? For example, visions of demons, or torture, or death that seem real. I know we've talked about playing with the image, say, put a dangling cigarette in the mouth of the demon, but many of us may not be able to do that skillful. Do you have any other advice and tips? Yeah, if you see a demon, you look at that demon in the eye and say, if you don't go right now, I'm going to report you to Ajahn Brahm. And the monster and the demon, and we'll run away. No, I'm joking about that, but that's actually true. It's a weird thing to find out that ghosts and spirits are afraid of monks and nuns too. You have way more power than any ghost or demon. The only thing, you don't realize that, you don't know that. So because of that, sometimes that a ghost comes up, you know, a real one, and you sort of get really scared. But the ghost can't harm you. It can make you scared as much as they can do. With my mate, again, mention him again, Professor Bernard Carr, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College, a close disciple of Stephen Hawking's. You're not the first person you would think. He's currently, I don't know if he's moved on, he was the treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London, so one of the committee members. And so, you know, we would, I say, research ghosts, another weird phenomena. And I know this, and he confirms it, that never ever has a ghost harmed a human being. And these are scientists collecting data, and all those years, you know, in England, and they're quite well known for their ghosts. He told me this story of this Australian girl told me it. This Australian woman going over to England, because when you, in Australia, there's nothing really that old. Well, there's oldish, but this particular place is so many old castles and dungeons and old palaces and so much history, many of which was quite violent and cruel. And so they went into this one castle, had to go and visit a castle while she was in England, and the guide took her downstairs into the dungeons. And it was just a really spooky place. Even though a modern woman just didn't believe in all that sort of religion nonsense, but nevertheless, the atmosphere was just very, very, very eerie. And every time they passed by an open window, not really glass in it, but just a ventilation slit, you might call, where people put arrows through or whatever, I'm not sure. But anyway, the wind would always whistle. And every time she stepped on a loose floorboard, and the doors would also just it was the most spooky place she'd ever been. And when she finished the tour, she couldn't help but ask the tour guide, "Have you ever seen any ghosts down here in the dungeons of this castle?" And the tour guide looked at her and said, "No, madam. In all the years I've lived down here, I've never seen any ghosts." And she had to ask, "How long have you been living in this castle?" 300 years, he said. That was a joke. But they never harmed anybody, so you don't have to worry about them. So if there are visions of demons, sometimes just stand your ground and just say, "Out, get out. It's not the right time." They have to go. If they know that you've got that confidence and you can send them out, they have to go. Anyway, Dhirajan, how do we know something is not a ghost? Who opened the door for us? Something is not a ghost. Who opened the door? How do you know the something who opened the door for us is not a ghost or whatever? I don't know. The point is, you don't. You don't know. No, it's usually ghosts don't mess around. So all this ghost stuff, remember, a lot of it is why people like to go. They like to be scared. It's weird, isn't it? They like to like Because sometimes we're so bored on a retreat. Anything which makes it interesting. Anyway, now the ghosts are okay. All the rebirth stories we heard so far are either from some location or nearby location, rebirth location. Can rebirth occur intercontinental? Can an Eskimo be born in the Sahara? Even better, can rebirth occur inter-solar system or inter-galaxy? Yeah, being reborn, sometimes, yeah, there was, oh, you can probably find this lady out. It was, she's on our committee. And she says that, you know, her son, I think, she was Sri Lankan, this woman, and her son insisted on using chopsticks. Would never eat, you know, like a Sri Lankan would eat with fingers usually. And this kid would always eat with chopsticks all the time. And so, you know, it was for the first 3 or 4, 5, 6 years, and then afterwards started using just the normal way of eating in Sri Lanka. But chopsticks, where did that one come from? And it obviously was Chinese before and decided to get rebirth in Sri Lanka. So that was in a different different continent. But inter-solar system, now that would be really cool, wouldn't it? If you actually had regression and you found yourself that you were in some extraterrestrial location. Now that would really be a good article. I know that, but anyway, people are afraid of extraterrestrials, but I always remember the great wisdom from Calvin, of Calvin and Hobbes' cartoon. And I think, was it him or was it? Anyway, he said, the surest, most certain sign there's intelligent life in outer space. The most obvious sign is intelligent life in outer space is that they haven't come to visit planet Earth. They're too intelligent. Anyway, intergalaxy, who knows? They may be among us now. How does practicing mindfulness and kindness lead to the cessation of desires? First of all, mindfulness allows you to get some data. You're aware, not of what you want to see, not of what you're hiding, because you'd find it too difficult to accept. You're actually being aware of what's actually here, gathering objective data. The kindness allows you to engage with this moment. So your data, you know, can be really focused and can be just not distorted by likes and dislikes. Because kindness, you know, you when you practice kindness, remember that saying of Mother Teresa, who just when she was picking up a homeless man with cancer who stank to high heaven. And he said, how can you do this? You know, because, you know, it must be so repulsive. And he said, no, because I'm kind. I can't even smell your bad smell. All I can see is your suffering and pain. And that's one of the things you can see with the kindness, is you don't sort of push away stuff which is smelly. And you don't just go for things which you like. The kindness, the openness, open the door of your heart no matter what you see, what you experience. That actually allows you to have a full set of data of, you know, desire and giving up desire. And of course, after a while, you say, what am I desiring for? What do you want? What is it you want? And sometimes you think, all these things which I wanted in life, it's only because people used to tell me, if I get that, then I'll be happy. And then after a while you found it didn't give you any happiness. Now that was like a short history of my life. When I was, this was in the UK, we did something, exams called the O-levels. So when I was about, I was a smart kid, fast-tracked, 14 or, actually I did my O-levels when I was 14. When I was, 14, I liked playing soccer. I already mentioned that. And so my parents and teachers said, don't spend so much time kicking a ball. Just, stay at home, do your homework, do some more study. Now, it's a bit of a sacrifice, yeah, I know, my parents and teachers said, but if you really do well at your O-levels, then, it's a great advantage in your career. Pass your O-levels and then you'll be happy. And I really thought that way. So, I followed my teacher's advice and my parents' advice, my family's advice, and I worked hard and did really well in the O-levels. You know what happens? Was I happy? No, now you've got A-levels. But A-levels, that's university entrance. So they told me, because I wasn't actually chasing football at those times, I was, as I said in my book, chasing girls. Actually, much more difficult than catching footballs. But there I was chasing girls, and my father was just, they hadn't died yet, but it was about to. And he was saying, my mum was saying, my grandparents were saying, don't go out too much, parties and messing around. Stay at home, study, do your homework, because if you pass your A-levels, then you'll be happy. And I believed them again. And I did really well in the A-levels. So, got to a great university like Cambridge. And then when I was at Cambridge, the lecturers and said, don't go playing around too much. Really put some energy and some effort in your studies. Because if you get a degree from Cambridge, then you'll be happy. And it was at that time I started to get suspicious. They all said, sacrifice this and work really hard and then afterwards you'll be happy. So I did my own little week research, looking at all the other people who had graduated. What did they do when they graduated? With honours, first class, they had to do research. More hard work. Get their PhD. And then while they were researching, now that's when they started to, start to accumulate some possessions. They needed a car, they needed nice clothes, a place to stay. And so they were working, doing like supervision tutorials to get a bit of money to pay their bills or doing something. And then you realize, why are you working so hard for? You're doing your PhD, but you're also, doing all this other work. He said, oh yeah, because when I pay off my car, then I'll be happy. When I get my PhD, then I'll be set. So they worked really hard. And by this time, they started sort of pairing off and then getting jobs, really bottom of the rung jobs, first of all. And they saved up for their marriage. They're working so hard. I said, what are you working so hard for? I thought, you got a degree, you should be able to relax now, get a nice income. I said, no, it doesn't work like that. I'm working really hard, but it doesn't matter. Because when we save up to get married, then we'll be happy. And of course, when you are married, then you've got to get a nicer house, and then someone goes and gets pregnant, and then you have more things to pay. And you see, now my friends who had got to that stage, they were working really, really hard. Both of them, and trying to get some childcare, were looking after the kid, and doing a couple of jobs, and big debts. And there's... You know what they said then? They said, oh, it doesn't matter, a little bit longer. The kids are growing up. When the kids grow up and leave home, then we'll be happy. And by that time, they're getting close to retirement age from their work. And so they're looking at their pension because they think, well, it's still hard work. I've got to do a bit more saving up. Now look after the kids. Work really hard because when I retire, then I'll be happy. And of course, as soon as you retire and you get your pension, it's never enough. And you get invited into all this voluntary work, like working on the committee of the Buddhist Society of West Australia or something else. Or Jhana Grove. And then you know what happens then? That is when you see all these old people going to churches, mosques, synagogues, temples. You know why most temples and churches are populated by old people. You know why? Because they have the idea, well, I'll just go there and listen to these boring sermons and chants and meditate even though I can't, because when I die, then I'll be happy. And that's most people's lives. When I die, then I'll be happy. When I get rid of my husband, then I'll be happy. Pay off my debts, then I'll be happy. And what happens here in Jhana Grove? When I get jhanas, then I'll be happy. More of the same, isn't it? When I get enlightened, then I'll be happy. When I get cured, then I'll be happy. When I finish the retreat, then I'll be happy. Why is it it's always happiness is sometime in the future and we never reach it? It's always, when this happens, then I'll be happy. And that's where I got really suspicious. No. Cessation of desires, trying to fulfill your desires, is endless. Just one more desire, just one more thing. And that's always one more afterwards. So that's for the cessation of desires. There's only one place that desires can end. Not when you get enlightened. Not when you get jhanas. Not when you win the lotto. Desires end now. That's the only place they can end, right now. But don't I need a nimitta first of all? Crikey. No, now. No desires. You mentioned yesterday that our minds create the realm we live in. Does this mean we currently live in our own mind-created world? The people around us we meet are created from our minds? Disprove it. Maybe it is. Your doubts are maybe created by your mind. Who knows? The mind is very powerful. Anyway, how do you spell the name of insane woman who was naked in the presence of the Buddha? The insane woman, what was that? T-H-A-T-C-H-E. First name Margaret. No, I'm only joking there. No, that was Patachara. P-A-T-A-C-A-R-A. Patachara. But it was just a temporary insanity because she couldn't take the suffering and just the shock of losing everything in just one day. Dear Champram, I do not see suffering as something which is neither good nor bad, rather something that simply is, which makes the cessation of suffering more favorable than continual rebirth in the Buddhist path. Suffering, this is actually one nice saying of Sariputta, and he was saying just what the enlightened ones say is suffering, the world says is happiness. What the world says is happiness, enlightened ones say is suffering. You get it round the wrong way. Always look at that sometimes when a baby is born. What's the first thing a baby does when it's born? Starts crying. When somebody dies, have you looked at them in the casket, in the coffin? They've got a lovely smile on their face. When a baby is born, it cries and everyone else smiles. When somebody dies, they're smiling and everyone else is crying. You get it the wrong way around. So, when you look at something really, when the cessation of the water for the frog, only then does it really understand what water is. Ajahn Brahm, what do you mean by unless you invite them, the ghost cannot come close to someone who keeps the precepts? does invitation of ghosts sort of happen? No. Come over here, ghosts, because we need some money for the nuns and monastery. So can you please give a lottery number? No, there was that other story. How are we going for time? It's not that bad. That other story of this person at home. And I think one of his relations had just died. So, you know, when he heard the sound, he's alone in the house. Go to casino. Go to the casino. He said, who said that? There's no one there. And so he thought he was just, you know, imagining things. He heard it a third time. Go to the casino. And it just sounded like his, you know, deceased uncle. So why not? So, you know, he got dressed, went to the casino, and then as he was walking in, he heard it the next time. Go to roulette table. Go to roulette table. So he went to the roulette table. And as he was watching, you know, the croupier throw the board in and twirl the ball, then he heard the voice say another time, put $100 on number 17. $10 first. $10 on number 17. Put $10 on number 17. So he put $10 on number 17. The croupier twirled the wheel, threw in the ball, went round and round, landed on number 17. And he could hear the ghost so clearly, yeah! Yay! And so then he heard the ghost say, put everything on number 26. The whole lot on number 26. So he put, you know, I don't know, what are the odds on a roulette wheel? 30 to 1 or something? 35 to 1? 26 to 1?
36.
36. Oh, no. That's without the cut to the house. I think it's 30 to 1 or 35 to 1. Anyway, so he put everything on $350 on number 26. He went round, all the way round and round and round. And he was really excited. His heart was pounding. And when it stopped, number 26, he won again. And this time, the ghost went, yay, yay, yay. And he thought other people could hear it, but no one could hear the ghost, just him. He said, put everything on number 21. Everything. A whole lot, it's a lot of money. Everything. So he put everything. How much is that? Maybe about $10,000 or something on number 21. And if this came up, it would be a fortune. He put everything on number 21. And this time people were watching him. Because it was a big bet. And the croupier put the ball, twirled the wheel, threw the ball, he went round and round. And even the croupier was just getting excited. And as it came to almost a stop, everyone, they held their breath. It went so quiet. And then the ball went in. 21. And bounced out to the number next. And he could hear very clearly the ghost shout, oh, shit. Even ghosts make mistakes. Okay. Okay, where are we going with this? Invitation of ghosts sort of happen. You realize you're doing it when you're sharing moments with departed loved ones, or you're radiating better towards all beings, or you're mixing, thinking of family relations, friends, dogs who have passed away. Could you please kind of explain the term invite, perhaps like the invitation of David chanting? Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, you can invite them in, but you know, if you don't like them because they're causing you trouble, you just send them out again. Only if there's enough time. Another bedtime story. The coffin ghost story. I think you all know that one, don't you? The coffin joke? I was giving it away. Well, maybe, let's just see what happens. But anyway, you only get these ghost stories if you invite them on a piece of paper. You mentioned dreams last night. Even though I feel peaceful during the day, I've been having angry dreams every night. Does this mean I'm angry in my subconscious? Can meditation help clear the anger? Of course it can. But one nice thing to do is really check when you go to sleep. tuck yourself in, get yourself comfortable, and then before you fall off into sleep, just make a nice resolution. May all beings be happy and well. May I be happy and well. May I have a nice, peaceful sleep. And if you do things like that, because what you take into bed with you is actually just what is in your dreams at night time. So if you have worries before you go to sleep, of course you're going to worry about things. If you're tight and tense, your body is a bit sort of, you know, unbalanced, of course it's going to create bad dreams. So see if you can actually create just this beautiful state of mind before you go to sleep. And you have a wonderful time in sleep. Do more ghosts. Crikey, you guys are obsessed with ghosts. Do ghosts only come in human form, or do you also have little ghosts, dogs, cats, guinea pigs, horses, mice, and muffins? A ghost muffin? Oh, I don't know, anyway. Anyway, yeah, the ghost dog story, there's a couple of ghost dog stories, but you know, this is one of the ones which many people know this generally. It doesn't mind being told his name. That was Pon of Pon's Gym. You know, he's a Thai martial artist. He runs a gym in Northbridge. But anyway, that his next door neighbour was a builder. Been together for a long time. Neighbours for a long time. And one day, the next door neighbour's dog, you know, who would always go to work with him in the utility, died. And, you know, he got very sick, and it was the builder just took it to the vet, and the vet sort of, you know, gave it the injection. It died in his arms. So, you know, no doubt the dog was dead. So, you know, a bit sad the dog had died. And then the next day, he got up to go to work, as usual, without the dog, and opened the door, and this dog ran past him. It was spitting image of his dog. Couldn't tell the difference between his dog, but his dog had died. And this dog just came right the way in and just went to every corner of the house where it would have a sleep. Just, you know, lay down for a couple of seconds, then visited another corner of the house, went outside to the back, which was open, where it would get a drink of water from a leaky tap. Knew exactly where to get the water from. And then ran up to the second story where the builder's wife was still in bed and just lifted its muzzle. And it was the morning ritual that before the dog would go to work with its owner, would kiss the builder's wife. It's the dog's mistress. And the wife was now half asleep in bed. She'd done this every morning, just give the dog a kiss, but she never realised it was a ghost, not a real dog. And just then the dog ran downstairs, and just the owner was actually taking photographs of it on his mobile phone. You know, this the ghost dog. And that's why Pon actually showed it to me, the pictures of this dog after it died. It looked exactly like a real dog. And then would usually go up into the back of the ute, the pickup tray of the ute, and would go to work with the owner. But the owner said, enough, and just chased the dog down the road. He never saw him again. The dog had one last visit home before he disappeared, and even kissed his mistress one last time. Ghost dog. Dear Ajahn, is it true that some other soul can enter your mind when you're in deep meditation? No. That is impossible. So, I don't know, why would they want to go in your mind? There's much better souls to go into than my mind. Because, you know, if I'm a monk, you can't eat in the afternoon, you can't do this. And so if a soul went into my mind, they'd get very disappointed. No, they can't do this. It only again happens, you know, if somebody is very old or weak or some sickness. But if you're in meditation, you just really are pretty invulnerable. try Ajahn Brahm at some point, can we, during the retreat, please do the loving kindness meditation where we ping someone we know at the end. You mentioned it in a previous talk. Yeah, we'll probably do that sort of on the last day. Hi. Why do so few Buddhist teachers emphasize the jhanas as much as you do? Because this is the modern... One of the reasons is because that the monks who were mostly in charge of the teachings decided it was just too difficult to teach jhanas to lay people. I'm apologized to say. But, you know, that even, I think I mentioned in Vietnam, I was told that they decided that monks were not allowed, not permitted to teach jhanas to lay people. And because they think it's just too troublesome. And then you get sort of rebels like me, and I came and many other people going around. At the time of the Buddha, lay people got jhanas. But what's so different today? So just give it a try. You know, because of your Western upbringing, you know, equity, this is unfair. So you go teaching jhanas, and some people can actually do it. Not everybody, but some manage it. So why not? Otherwise it's unfair. So anyway, so we teach them. So they become more popular now. When the Buddha was discussing the five hindrances as a group, the first two are always karma, chanda, and vayapada, sense desire and aversion. These two words are used for the hindrances in the Satipatthana as per the usual usage. But it's also used as lokeya bija, as a synonym for karma, chanda, and domanasa. When the Buddha mentions this vinaya, lokeya, bija, domanasa, and the refrain of the Satipatthana, refers to five hindrances. If it was meant to be the five hindrances, why doesn't he just say panchanivarana, the five hindrances? I'm not quite sure why the Buddha wouldn't say that in that context, but in the Anguttara Nikaya, if you look at every time we mention the five hindrances, you'll find not just two or three, but I never actually counted, but 50 or 60 times. The first hindrance is lokeya bija. And check it out these days, it's easy. I had to do that just by hand, just reading and reading. Didn't have a computer, but these days you can just get on the computer and check out lokeya bija. And it's many times, the first of the five hindrances. And domanasa, I only found two places where domanasa was a synonym for vayapada, but it's there. And of course, afterwards, check the commentaries to the two Satipatthana suttas, Mahasatipatthana Sutta in the Digha, and the Satipatthana Sutta, I think Samyutta number 10. Majjhima. And there you'll find the commentaries say specifically, lokeya bija means the first, is a synonym for karmachanda. Domanasa, synonym for vayapada. These represent the first two hindrances. And in Pali, when you have the first two of a well-known group, the other three are inferred. So the commentaries to the first, both Satipatthana suttas, both say they refer to the five hindrances. And it makes a lot of sense as well. Why are we... you have to weaken those five hindrances before you can do Satipatthana. I remember one of the first books I saw on the Satipatthana was written by these two Sri Lankan monks who'd gone over, actually mostly Somatera, who'd gone over to Burma because they had heard if you practice Satipatthana for 7 days, you can be either fully enlightened or a non-returner. So they went over there to actually to become either a non-returner or fully enlightened. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, in the preface to their translation, they said, well, you know, we've been here for about 3 or 4 weeks, we haven't got anywhere yet, so instead we'll translate the sutta. And sometimes it will, the Buddha doesn't lie. If the Buddha was saying you can do this in 7 days and become fully enlightened, it must mean you're not following the instructions properly. Just like in that old story, old monks don't lie. They shot the arrow instead of letting the arrow fly. And so what were they doing wrong? And then I started reading that, and it's obvious. They had not weakened the five hindrances enough. Just know Vinaya, like the Vinaya. It's like restraint, training, discipline, whatever you wish to call it. It's not abandoning the five hindrances, but subduing them, restraining them, to the point where you can be mindful without sloth and torpor, without restlessness, without wanting, without ill will, without doubt, you know exactly what you're doing. And then if you practice Satipatthana, you've got a good chance of losing a lot of your defilements. So the evidence is out there. Hey, this is the same, this is about the third one of this handwriting. I may be from yesterday. Well, I have a friend who saw someone hung on the tree dead. She was severely traumatized. How can I help advise her? Oh, maybe Prasad, you were there when we had Mr. Duffy's point. So there was a gentleman who committed suicide. I don't know, how many years ago was that? I don't know. It was nothing to do with us. They found his car parked at the lookout. And that. So the police came and said, have you seen this fellow? Because he's a bit sort of depressed, and we didn't see him. And so they got on their horses. They were looking for this fellow, Mr. Duffy. And I don't know how the police could miss it. Because later on, it was just on the road up the what we call the Hermit's Hill. And you were walking, who with? Oh, with you, Jadika. And then you saw this shape on the tree. It was Mr. Duffy. And how long have you been up there when he was found? 7 months. It's a beautiful place because it had wonderful sunsets up there. I know you were a bit freaked out. I think at the time you wanted to go back straight away. But it's fine. The family came up afterwards. You know, the police came up to remove the body or whatever. I think they did a cursory investigation. But I remember Venerable Mudita, I think he was there as well. Mudu. Okay, because I remember anyway, they went up there a couple of days later once the police had there. I had to call the police because the police had left a foot. There's a foot left. And they hadn't taken it away, so you better take the whole set. It's a bit gross, but it's only stuff like that. Yeah. When I was in Thailand, and we could always go to the autopsy room in Sirirat Hospital. And the first time I went, where they performed autopsies, because you were monk, you just walk in there and just watch everything, and it was fascinating. But this is absolute truth. I couldn't believe this when I saw this. In the autopsy room in Sirirat Hospital, that's the other side of the river from the main palace in Wat Mahathat, they had, it's like a lecture theatre. They had this big, what was it called? That's basically a bench. It was stainless steel, I think, with they could drain any liquids there. So that's where they would do the autopsies. And then because it was a teaching hospital, they had like the lecture theatre in rows going up, 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 up. And they also had these high windows. They didn't want anyone like looking in. So they had these high windows. And I looked at those high windows and it looked like a pot plant, but it wasn't a pot plant. It looked like a human head on a plate, something you'd see in some horror movie. And because, the autopsy hadn't started yet and I was the first one in the lecture theatre, that I walked up the top there and it was a human head on a plate, a real one. Poked it, and it was real. To this day, I don't know what it's doing up there. But, because of maybe my upbringing, I was saying, I thought, this is really cool.
a human head on a plate on the window where you'd usually expect a pot plant. I suppose it was there to keep away sort of intruders who shouldn't be there. But it didn't mind about me. Anyway, saw someone hung on the tree dead. So if that was the case, they're dead, they're gone a long time ago. Why are you traumatized? The person who's dead might be traumatized. No, not even they're traumatized. They're gone now. They're reborn. But are the birds traumatized? Why are you traumatized? One of the things is because, you know, human beings these days, they're just not used to death. Maybe because, you know, I shook my father when he was dead. If you feel what it's like for dead, it's someone you really love and care for. And I was always like scientific. I always liked to actually find out what's actually going on in that human body. I was interesting rather than repelled. And later on in Thailand, in Wat Nanachat, we'd have all the cremations right there. And I remember one of the first cremation places, you always have, you know, they'd put it, made it out of wood, lots of wood, and then you put the coffin on top. It wasn't much of a coffin, very cheap, and because of villagers. And they always have to have one person there stay overnight, you know, next to the coffin, because I did that one. I don't know why, you can't really predict it. Some people are really hard to burn. Other people, they go up pretty quickly. But this fellow is a fellow, you know, he's on the top of the wood, and it took forever to burn. And I had to be there with a big stick, because every time an arm was about to fall off, I had to sort of put it back on the fire. And also, I didn't really hit the dogs, but, you know, make them really scared. Because to them, the dogs, it was a good meal. I had to keep them away out of respect for the family. Stay up, you know, all night, just, you know, watching the thing burn and just put it back up there so it could burn properly. It was just life. It's only a body. And what are people so attached to bodies for? It's dead. It's gone. But one thing I also learnt, when you do these cremations, you know, open ones, they always put the body on the side, never on its back. Because maybe some of the doctors might know this, because if you put it on its back, just the way it burns and the way the muscles contract, if you put it on its back, and sometimes I saw this because it actually twisted, you know, it's only a fire, so as a fire, the wood that settled, sometimes instead of being on its side, it was on its back. And then it would actually sit up. Not only that, it would sit up, but just the nature of the hands. And it would freak people out. It's just a natural phenomenon, that's all. It's not so psychic or anything, it's just the nature of the contractions and the burning of the muscles. Well, that was what it was. That was really funny when that happened. Anyway, that was it. So, you don't need to be so traumatized. If you're traumatized, actually, the nicest thing is to go back and see some more dead bodies. There ain't dead bodies, there's nothing. It's just old, an old body hasn't got any use anymore. Hopefully that all of you are organ donors. That, you know, when you die, you've already signed in there to give your organs to actually for people who really need them much more than you do. So I can take every organ. I don't need them anymore. It's really good karma. And I think, what was it? I'm not quite sure if this is still true, but I was told in Spain that there's no need for dialysis centres because their organ donors are so good. There's always a sort of a kidney for someone who needs one. And I don't know if you've been to dialysis centres. I remember going to one just, you know, to try and give some support to people who are under dialysis. And just, it takes up so much of your life getting to a dialysis centre. And the fact that in Spain they don't need them. I was so great, the Spanish, at least they've got enough kidneys so that everyone who needs one can have one. Well done, the Spanish. Anyway, hi Ajahn Brahm, if something makes you happy but makes someone else unhappy, should you do it? In other words, are we responsible for other people's happiness or chiefly for our own? Okay, it's not. So the answer to the question is, when I do marriage ceremonies for people and I look at the bride and I tell her, now you're a married woman, you mustn't think of yourself, she says. I look at the guy and I look at him and say, you're now a married man, you must not think of yourself. And so I'm sorry, but this is my experience. In Australia, and I've done many, many, many marriage blessings, in Australia, the guy always pauses. He does. Not all the guys, but most of them. And then eventually, okay, yeah. And then still looking at the guy, I just, and you must not think of her from now on. You mustn't think of your wife. And he doesn't say anything. He's confused. And I quickly turn to the wife and say, you're a married woman now, you must never think of him from now on. And these are wonderful moments. Because even all the relations, if they haven't heard me say this before, they think, shall we get another monk to do this ceremony? This one is crazy. And then, of course, the punchline, the answer to the riddle, said, now you are a married couple, must never think of yourself, must never think of your partner. You must only think of us. Us. The third option. So, but even thinking of us, that sometimes, well, that happens. You can't always both be happy. But the responsibility is we're in it together. So we have to learn how we can compromise. So how we can compromise, you know, some people say, oh, it's just so difficult. We have to make decisions. Why is it always his decision? Or sometimes say, why does she always have to be right? So there is a way. And I mentioned this to somebody even very recently. They're about to get married. And we call it the calendar method. It's fair. Because look, if you are a couple and got married, you know, she may be the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Smart, powerful, but she cannot convince her husband that she's always right. And he may be a top lawyer who argues complicated cases in the Supreme Court. He may be a great lawyer, but there's no way he can convince his wife she's wrong. You're just wasting your time arguing. So instead of arguing and wasting all that time and getting this terrible feeling of who's right and who's wrong, compromise on the calendar method. Have a look of the day of the week, or the day of the month, sorry. If it's an odd day of the month, then she's right. If it's an even day, he's right. That way you don't have to argue, you get a decision straight away, and also it's fair. Even. Odd days she's right, even days he's right. And I'm sure you've already figured out that the girl gets a few more days she's right every year. It's worth it, guys, don't worry, just give her a few extra. And it also means that if she's right today, you know, you get your own back tomorrow, guys, and he'll be right. And that was working perfectly. And I thought, wow, a wonderful compromise that was. But the problem came when Australia legalized same-sex marriages. So now I don't know what to do, and it's an odd day, an even day. And they're both girls or they're both boys. So I can't, that didn't work with same-sex marriages. Anyway. Okay, so sometimes it makes some people happy. Sometimes what if you're a dentist? You make your patient unhappy. Ah, it hurts. Ah. So you make your patient unhappy, but it's good for them in the long run. So sometimes, what is happiness? Sometimes, out of compassion, I teach these stories to you and you don't want to hear them, but I teach them out of compassion and kindness to you. It hurts, but... Anyway, dear Ajahn, can lay people become enlightened or become an Aryan if he/she keeps the five precepts and practice letting go, meditation, attain jhanas? Of course they can. So why do people become monks if you can become enlightened being a layperson? The answer is, can you go from Jhana Grove to Sydney without going in an aircraft or a car or a vehicle? Of course you can. You can walk from here to Sydney. It's possible. But who in their right mind would do that when you've got these cheap airfares these days? So that's what the airfare is there for, the aircraft is there for. Easy way. So this is the easy way. Being a monk or a nun. The easy way to enlightenment. Okay, so all I have to do is overcome the hindrances by letting them go and follow the nice feelings. I am the hindrances, right? Yeah, you are made up of the hindrances. So I just keep ignoring them and the path will naturally unfold and I simply follow the breadcrumb trail all the way to enlightenment. Is this the right way of seeing it? Oh, that'll do for the time being. This time of night, I'm not so judgmental. That'll do. Okay. The Buddha taught us to make an island of ourselves and to walk the path alone was better than walking with a fool. Yet the Buddha was firm with Ananda. How noble friends were 100% of the path. Peach, can you reconcile his positions? Yeah. If it's with a fool, that's not good walking with them. But if it was noble friends, then go with as many as you can find. So what was the fool? Or what? So if you can find good friends, amazing, go together. But if you can't find a good friend, then alone. There's nothing wrong with solitude. Because when there's no one else around, are you alone? Whenever I'm around, whenever I am in solitude, there's always someone there. I'm never alone. Who's there? Me. So that's the difference between solitude and loneliness. If you're lonely, it means you don't like yourself. Your relationship with yourself needs to be fixed. That's why you want to run away. You find solace in other people, or in doing stuff, in running away somewhere, in work, in so-called achievements. And when you're by yourself, you don't know how to live with yourself. But I'm the first person I see when I wake up in the morning. You know what I say to myself? Good morning, me. Have a nice day. And the last thing I say when I go to sleep at night, good night, me. Have a nice night. See you in the morning. Night. Why not? Because even if you're married, it's still you're the last person you see before you nod off to sleep. Say, good night, me. See you in the morning. It's a good way of learning how to be kind to yourself. So that I'm a good friend of me. So that means, and that's why I also say, you know, I think I did this already about hugging yourself. Because it's really difficult these days. All these rules and regulations and Me Too and sexual harassment and something. You want to give someone a hug, and then you give them a hug and you get into trouble afterwards. If it's not for misunderstanding, sexual harassment, sometimes you catch a disease. There's lots of disease. I think I mentioned to you I've got a disease, didn't I? Infectious disease. I think I mentioned that the first day. That was hepatitis. No, sorry, not hepatitis. Happy-titis. Happy-titis be highly contagious, be careful. Your thoughts on Buddha fields, being with a master. How they can purify an empty one versus meditating with others, a group, or going alone out in nature. Why did you say being with a master? Master is gender specific. So one day that we're having it was in Hong Kong. We had a debate between two masters. I think one was Mahayana Zen, and it's me. And I said, why are those men? Why can't we have a woman come in a debate? So we can have a debate between a master and a mistress. And they said, that wouldn't go down so well, because mistress has other secondary meanings. So that didn't actually get very far. So, a master and a mistress. And if I'm a master, then you must be slaves. Is that right? Because sometimes people, they do that. They call me master, and I say, slave. I got my premier slave sitting in the back. Over there. That's her official title, premier slave. But if you don't do the right thing, you get demoted to number two slave. She won't accept that. Anyway, we're going Buddha fields. Oh yeah. It is true that other people affect you. You know, this is where that being with peaceful, good, kind, easygoing, loving people, you do feed on that. And that's why it was so great being around someone like an Ajahn Chah. It was so wonderful being with someone like what's his name, Ajahn Tate. Because you get so peaceful and so happy, and you know, you feel like you're loved and accepted. And that was the one that, I probably told a story, but such a wonderful story. That was when I went to see this Ajahn Tate. And I was a young monk. I was scared, because now these monks, they do have powers, and maybe they could read my mind. And I wasn't really that ready to have my mind read, you know, in case he told what I was thinking about most of the time. And so but I had these questions I wanted to ask him. You know, just like you have these questions, I had these really deep questions. Bothered me for a long time. I wanted to get, you know, like a second opinion, not just from Ajahn Chah, but from this Ajahn Tate. So, you know, went all that way. It's a long way from Ajahn Chah's monastery, and then had to wait, you know, for a time for the interview, just like you have to. And then I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and then finally had my chance for the interview with this great monk, Ajahn Tate. And he was the monk, Sirirat Hospital. That's when I first went to Thailand. He was dying of cancer in that hospital. Looked after by His Majesty the King of Thailand. All things paid for. And then doctors say, no point anymore. Nothing more we can do. You're going to die. So the doctors were right. So he said, well, I might as well just go and die in my monastery. So he went up to Hin Mak Peng Monastery, and about another 20 years before he died. The doctors were right, but they got the timing really off. He's a wonderful monk. And when I went to see him, the King of Thailand had built him this big mandapa, very built just for him. And there's this little frail old monk in a wicker chair, just looking over the Mekong River, over to the other side in Laos. And you can see that he didn't belong in such luxury, you know, in this amazing little room. But it didn't matter when he turned around to look at me. All my questions, every one of them just vanished, evaporated. And instead I just got this incredible blast of total acceptance, loving kindness. The door of his heart was totally open to me. I didn't need to become perfect. With all my faults and stupidities, all the misconceptions, everything, I was just accepted. Beautiful kindness. And then he said, well, any questions? And then I said, well, it's probably best I find the answers myself. He said, yeah, well done, yeah, you find the answers yourself. But then I just sat there. And the thought came up that they're going to have to get some of the strongest water buffaloes from the village to drag me out of here. I'm just going to die here. Because in the presence of such acceptance, it was so rare and precious, I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go back to Wat Bapong with Ajahn Chah or anybody. Just here. He says, I'm going to stay here. That's when you felt this incredible just being at ease. And it wasn't I was perfect. It was I didn't need anything. I didn't need to be perfect. All my desires to answer questions and find out the answers to things, all my wanting, you know, to have no stupid thoughts in my head. When I didn't have any wanting, I was content. All those thoughts, they just vanished. No restlessness, no tiredness. Just at ease. I remember that. That's one of the reasons I say, why are you trying to improve yourself? You're more than good enough. But trying to improve yourself, wanting, craving, that just goes round and round in samsara. Always trying to be better, never reaching that end, until one day you come across some wisdom and you're good enough. So stop wanting, stop craving, stop trying to improve. And then your mind gets so peaceful and still. Just jhanas just can't be resisted. Enlightenment just happens. Nothing to do with you. It's when you let go. Let go trying to be someone you're not. Perfect. So anyway, that was reminiscing of good old Ajahn Tate. Now someone did ask, the coffin ghost. And I remember sometimes people ask, Ajahn Brahm, now can't we get more kids coming to temples? And I say this because the last time I was in California, it was David Kittelstrom. He was the main editor, I think, or the CEO of Wisdom Publications. You know, published all those books, you know, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, and Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung, and Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. So he wanted to see me, and so he brought his 7 or 8 year old kid. And, you know, she didn't want to go to the temple, because temples are boring. What am I going to do then? Meditate? Boring. Listen to monks or nuns? Boring. So he warned me that, you know, she'd be restless. And so I decided to take the opportunity of telling her about the coffin. And she was hanging on every word, sitting on his lap, and she was looking at me. Because I told the story of this man who went to a Buddhist temple. And after the talk was finished, you know, it was late. And there was two ways to get back to his house, not that far away. He could either just go the long way round along the streets, or he could take the shortcut directly across the cemetery. And of course, he was a rational person, a scientist, no ghosts. And if there are ghosts, they can't harm you. So he decided to take the shortcut across the cemetery. And as he was walking, I don't know why it is, but they do have lights, street lights, along the paths through the cemetery, but they're always further apart than along the streets. So it's always more dark and more shadows. So he got halfway across the cemetery. And it was, nothing had happened, everything was fine. And he continued on, not that far to the gate, the other side of the cemetery, and just a short distance from there to his house. But then, have you ever had that feeling that something is following you? You know, it's one of these things about a human being, they can sense that someone is behind them, even though they can't see it. And he thought that something was following him. So he just automatically just started walking a little bit faster. And as he started walking a little bit faster, this time he could actually hear it. Something was following him. At least it's how it seemed. Bump. 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 So I decided to really walk fast. And as he started walking fast, he was coming close to the end of the cemetery. Bump. 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 It was louder and clearer. Something was bumping behind him. And then he made his big mistake. He turned around to look, just in case. And what he saw drained all the colour out of his face. His lips started to quiver, and his eyes went wide, and his heart pumped furiously. This was really scary, because what he saw, believe it or not, was a coffin, which had obviously just come out from the ground, because it was standing vertical. You know, the coffin shape, narrow and then a little bit pointed at the end and then truncated at the top. With earth, soil and cobwebs falling off it. Bump, 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 as it was coming towards him. And even as a scientist, you don't think, this is impossible, this can't happen. You ran. He ran as fast as he could. And he got to the end of the cemetery, but he could hear behind it, bump, bump, bump. It was actually chasing him. But he wondered whether he can go outside the cemetery. But when he turned the corner along the road by the cemetery, bump, 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 it was on the sidewalk of the road outside, following him. And so he ran as fast as he possibly could, just sweating, heart pounding, and he could still hear it behind him. Bump, bump, bump. It was actually catching him up. And so when he got to the garden gate, he didn't open the gate. He just jumped right over it. Bump, bump, bump. And he heard the coffin coming. He looked behind. It was almost at the gate itself. And so he got to the doorway of the house. When he heard the coffin couldn't jump the gate. Bump! Against the gate's woodwork. And so he got out his keys, dropped them on the ground. Bump! As the coffin broke the hinges of the garden gate. So he didn't have time to choose. He just picked up the first key, put it in the keyhole. So lucky. It fat. He turned it, opened the door, jumped inside. Bump, bump, bump! Exactly, that's how he felt. He jumped inside, slammed the door, and just as the coffin came to the front door, he was breathing heavily, sweat pouring off him. He was inside the house now, safe. You can actually see the coffin just, you know, through the glass. You know, you always have this glass at the front of your house. Bump! Bump! As the coffin started to break down the strongest door in the house, the front door, the entrance door. Bump! He could see the hinges start to splinter. So he ran up the stairs to the top story of the second story, it's only two stories, up to the top, and this bump! One more bump! And the door fell flat. And you could see the coffin on the ground, looking this way. He saw the man at the top of the stairs. Bump, bump, bump. The coffin started to climb the stairs. There's only one other room in the whole house which had a lock, the bathroom. So he ran in the bathroom, shut the door and locked it. Bump! Bump! On the bathroom door. And he knew that if that coffin could break down the garden gate and the front door, it'd only be a matter of seconds before it broke through the bathroom door. Bump! And one more bump! And the bathroom door gave way. And there was the fellow, spread-eagled against the wall. As the coffin broke through and saw him. There was no more escape as the coffin came towards him. And without even thinking, he grabbed whatever he could from the shelves of the bathroom and threw it at the coffin. And there's a bottle of some brown, smelly liquid, and it went all over the coffin. And that coffin never moved again. It stopped right there. Because what he threw on that coffin was called cough mixture. It stops the coffin. That's what the pharmacy says. So it's only a joke. It's only a story. But the daughter of David Kittleson, she can't wait till I go to California. She'll come to every one of my talks. Sitting on. And afterwards, when he got to the only cough mixture, she was bursting out laughing. So I think he was very happy with me because at last he made sort of going to the temple one of the coolest ways to spend the evening to his little daughter. And so that was really nice. So anyway, so make sure this evening you get some cough mixture in your bathroom, just in case. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I apologise because I really get into the theatrics of it. Okay, very good. Have a good night. You're perfectly safe.